Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. And again, this month's selections were written by Jeffon Seely. The solution is consciousness. Our healing does not lie in the subtraction of our pain, but in the realization of our wholeness. Angel Kyodo Williams. Anything you can dream of is not too great for you to undertake if it hurts no one and brings happiness and good into your life. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 288. The solution to any problem we face, individually or collectively, is consciousness. It is the level of our consciousness that brings about the effects we see in the external world. All external experiences have a direct relationship with consciousness. From a human standpoint, we assist in causing all the effects we see. This may be directly or indirectly, but we're never neutral. It would appear that the current level of the collective consciousness on this planet is deeply cemented in the concept of survival. In other words, be as concerned as you can with yourself and your immediate family unit. As consciousness moves out from this center of self, less concern is given. This level of consciousness fuels division, conflict, and suffering. Imagine if we ascended in consciousness, resurrected to a Christ-like level. Imagine if we shifted from survival to compatibility, where my well-being and the well-being of people on the other side of the world, whom we'll never meet, are just as important as your well-being, where the well-being of Earth and future generations is just as important as the well-being of your closest family member today. A consciousness of compatibility is the key to the new paradigm, and this level of consciousness can only come from within you. Affirmation. Everything I do this day adds to the well-being of all humans on this planet. My consciousness is expanding. I am ascending. And on this one, please forgive my pronunciation. Ihang Tong Juan Dakota Oyate. We are all visitors to this time and place. Our purpose is to observe, learn, grow, and return what we can. Odguru Nunukal. In the beginning, God. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 63. My wife and I were driving through her hometown in a quiet and remote corner of South Dakota. The land stretched flat before us, the morning wind gentle, the town still. This is the homeland of the Heang Tong Juan Dakota Oyate, part of the Dakota people whose roots trace back to northern Minnesota, caretakers of sacred land and keepers of ancient wisdom. As we drove, I found myself reflecting not on loss alone, but on the enduring resilience carried through generations. Though history records displacement, broken agreements, and great suffering, it also reveals something deeper, a people who endured, adapted, and remained spiritually rooted despite unimaginable change. When I look into my wife's eyes, into my son's, an enrolled member of the tribe, and when I speak with elders or watch the children laugh and play, I feel a quiet strength that has not been extinguished by time or circumstance. Science of Mind teaches us that while we cannot change the past, we can choose how we meet the present. We can acknowledge what has been, honor the land beneath our feet, and allow compassion, awareness, and reverence to guide how we live now. In doing so, we participate in healing, not by carrying guilt, but by awakening to our shared humanity and our responsibility to live consciously, lovingly, and with respect for all life. Affirmation. I share compassion with the earth beneath me, the history behind me, the future before me, and the moment of now. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, shine. I shine as a powerful, radiant light in the world. There are people who simply shine, who light up any room they enter with the power of their presence. This is the light of God, of Spirit, of the universe, shining through them. Like these special ones, I have the ability to shine because the light of God, of Spirit, of the universe, is within me, too, as my health, energy, and strength. When I feel discouraged by a world that seems dark, I remember the truth of God, of Spirit, of the universe, as light and love and the world's people as diverse in humanity, but united in divinity. When I want to shine my inner light brighter, I remember I am a divine being with a powerful purpose. I greet each day with hope and positive expectation. As I live, love, and serve, I shine the light of God, blessing all those I meet and inspiring them to shine brightly as well. Joy. I find joy in the quiet moments. Joy abounds in moments big and small. It is easy to find joy in life's grander moments, weddings, births, and graduations, milestones that count among my happiest memories. But joy also lives in the smaller moments, in the little things that delight my senses and gladden my heart. Brilliantly colored birds singing, the sun shining, the aroma of my favorite foods cooking, and my pets so happy to see me. Those things and so many more bring a smile to my face and joy to my heart. The presence of God feels especially close at these times when I am delighted and joyful. My heart fills with gratitude for all the things that give me joy, that make my life feel full of wonder, and that give me the calm assurance that God, Spirit, the universe, is with and within me always. And from The Bright Side, quotes to inspire and empower by the editors of Guideposts, life is sweeter when you have an attitude of gratitude. Dolly Parton, singer. We rarely ever see the full spectrum of God's plan, and our simple deeds can spiral into much bigger blessings. Delilah, radio host. One day you will look back and see that all along you were blooming. Morgan Harper Nichols, artist and writer. Whenever you feel you've fallen short, perhaps what's really happened is that you've taken a step back to get a running start on the future. Kristen Harmel, author. We think it's the big things that are going to change the world, but it's all the little things added together that make life matter. Jennifer Dukes Lee, author. God can do in 60 seconds what you can't do in a lifetime. Give God the wheel. Cheryl Lee Ralph, Emmy-winning actor. I believe that some obstacles work out for the better because God knows that without those, you wouldn't be as strong as you are. Simone Biles, Olympian. What you do with yourself between the last time you heard from God and the next time you hear from God is the ongoing challenge of a life of faith. Cece Winans, gospel singer. We return to Science of Mind for Steph Swink's monthly column, Ask Steph. Change, grow, and love more. My daughter married at 20 years old, and it lasted less than a year. Now she's in love with a non-binary person. She brought this person to dinner, and it was awkward for my husband, who barely said a word then or since. My daughter acted like nothing was wrong, but won't return my calls. It's always been a challenge for her and my husband to communicate. I'm afraid this may break their relationship. What should I do? Communication is the process of exchanging information, ideas, thoughts, feelings, and messages through speaking or writing. Our willingness to consciously and considerately engage in this exchange makes or breaks relationships. For a wife and mom, making everything okay between your husband and child may feel instinctual, but their relationship is not your responsibility. However, your relationships with each of them are. In your question, there's no mention of your thoughts or feelings. A common temptation for those of us wired to prioritize others over ourselves is to create a justifiable out from acknowledging our own experience. What is your reaction to your daughter's current love interest and your husband's behavior? Explore your heart and what you want for yourself and your family through journaling. If being a loving, accepting, and supportive space for one another is a priority, share that. Then invite them into a safe space to exchange information, being sure to impart your honest feelings and sincerely inquire about theirs. If avoidance continues, write them each a letter. Although we naturally have our own good ideas about what is best for our loved ones, we can't possibly know the intricacies of their soul's evolutionary journey. Ideally, you and your husband are willing to trust your daughter and accept her new love. Your family reflects beautifully the family of humanity. Ultimately, it's all about love and its infinite expressions. When we do our best to live in integrity with our hearts, there's no place for right or wrong, just change and growth and more love. And from the same issue, we turn to an article by Joseph and Sonia Nelson, Creation, the Mirror of Mind. The great spiritual teachings of the world, from the Hebrew scriptures to the metaphysical philosophy of Ernest Holmes, affirm a single profound truth. Creation is already complete in the mind of God. What we call manifestation is not the making of something new, but the unveiling of what exists eternally. Genesis 2:1 reads, "The heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them, and that God rested from all his work which he had done." In The Science of Mind, Holmes wrote that the ideas of God, of spirit, of the universe, are complete and perfect, and it is our recognition of them that causes them to appear. In his book, Creative Mind and Success, Holmes further said there is nothing manifest but that there is a cause for the manifestation. That cause is thought, conscious or unconscious, which produces the condition. This is the metaphysical parallel to Genesis. Creation is eternally finished in divine mind, and our role is not to make things happen, but to recognize what is already true. When we contemplate the idea that all things already exist, we may experience a deep shift in consciousness. Instead of seeing ourselves as separate beings struggling to acquire what we lack, we begin to understand that we are expressions of an infinite source, drawing from a universal reservoir in which no good thing is missing. Everything we could ever desire, peace, healing, abundance, love, creativity, is already present in potential form, awaiting our recognition and acceptance. This teaching aligns seamlessly with Ecclesiastes 1:9. There is nothing new under the sun. Nothing new is ever created in the absolute sense. Everything is revealed when consciousness becomes aware of it. If God is in all, through all, and is all, as Scripture, Holmes, and other metaphysical teachers affirm, then every sincere desire has its origin in the infinite. We're not left alone to toil, strain, or beg for our good. Instead, desire itself becomes a signal that some divine idea is seeking expression through us. The desire is the beginning of its fulfillment. As Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote in his poem, The Informing Spirit, "There is no great and no small to the soul that maketh all, and where it cometh, all things are, and it cometh everywhere." In John 14:13-14, Jesus proclaimed, "Whatever you ask in my name, that will I do." Not as a promise of future intervention, but as a reminder that what we ask for already exists in the eternal now. Asking in my name means asking from a consciousness aligned with divine truth, where the prayer recognizes that the good we seek is already prepared. Conceive and then manifest. In Science of Mind, desire is not a sign of lack, but a sign of divine movement. It is the impulse of spirit within our own consciousness, urging us toward greater expression. If we can imagine a good, then we can experience it, for the imagining is the first stage of its unfoldment. This principle of conceiving in the invisible before manifesting in the physical is a metaphysical truth demonstrated by real-world visionaries like engineer and inventor Nikola Tesla, who pioneered alternating current electricity. Tesla embodied this creative process. He began every invention in deep mental focus, visualizing, testing, and refining entirely in his imagination before touching any raw materials. Like Holmes taught, Tesla's work illustrates that creation begins in the invisible realm of thought, the formless, where we perfect ideas before they manifest into visible form. Central to both the teachings of the Bible and of Science of Mind is the principle of divine unity. There is one power, one presence, one life. We live in a universe where mind is the causal factor, and that mind is singular. When we think, God thinks through us. When we focus attention, we activate a spiritual law that takes our mental pattern and reproduces it in form. In Science of Mind, we call this the law of mental equivalence. Why our thoughts matter? Our thoughts matter because, as Scripture teaches, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. It is also why Jesus emphasized again and again that belief is the determining factor in demonstration. Our thoughts matter, not because they force God's hand, but because they are God's thoughts individualized through us. Every focused intention is a point of divine mind recognizing itself in a specific form. Thus, what we hold in consciousness becomes what we experience in our lives, not as a moral judgment, but as a law of spiritual causation. The question then is, if God is the only mind, how do we explain suffering, fear, or negativity? Science of Mind and biblical teachings inform us that all experiences, including suffering, arise within one divine reality, and there is no opposing power to God. In Isaiah 45:7, God said, "I form the light and create darkness." In Deuteronomy 32:39, God said, "I wound and I heal." There is only God, Spirit, the universe. There is no second power. Nothing exists outside the infinite. Holmes insists that evil has no actual presence in God. It is not a cosmic force, but a human misperception, an outpicturing of limited belief. When we dwell on fear, anger, or separation, we create conditions that reflect those patterns. When we focus on harmony and unity, we bring forth good. The creative mind is impartial. And as Holmes taught, universal law corresponds to us based on what we believe in our hearts and minds. The world we see is the mirror of the thoughts we hold. This is why spiritual practice is essential, not to please God, but to align ourselves with truth. The essence of faith. Hebrews 11:3 reads, "What is seen was not made out of things that are visible," thus affirming that the invisible realm of mind precedes physical form. Romans 4:17 adds that God, Spirit, the universe, calls those things which be not as though they were. Science of Mind translates this principle into metaphysical language. Faith is a mental acceptance of the unseen as already accomplished. Faith is simply an inner knowing. It is ease, not effort. It is the quiet certainty that because the idea exists in divine mind, its expression is inevitable when we align our consciousness with it. Consider this. When we focus on a desire as though it were already fulfilled, we align with the eternal completeness of divine mind. Our focus does not create, it reveals. God does not change circumstances for us. We change our perception to match what God already has prepared. This is the heart of metaphysical creation. Our lives unfold at the pace of our awareness. We do not pull blessings out of the sky. We awaken to what has always been. Just as the seed already contains the full-grown tree in potential form, divine mind contains the fullness of our life. We constantly discover, but do not invent, the good that awaits us. When we hold a desire, goal, or vision, our work is not to wonder how it will happen or whether it will happen, but to accept that it already exists in divine mind. The question becomes where we align our consciousness with the finished idea. Can we live from the end rather than trying to make the end occur? This is faith, not longing, not hoping, not begging, but knowing. We do not have faith in something non-existent. True faith acknowledges the eternal reality behind the unseen. Faith is not a creative strain. It is spiritual relaxation. It is resting in the awareness that creation is complete, and we simply catch up to the divine blueprint. Creation is finished in God's, Spirit's, the universe's mind, yet it always unfolds in our experience. We're not trying to persuade God to bless us. We align with the blessings that already exist. Neville Goddard said, "Faith is loyalty to the unseen reality. It is trust in the completeness of divine mind. The more we recognize this truth, the more effortlessly our lives express harmony, abundance, and peace. Our task is readiness. Our practice is alignment. Our power is awareness. Creation is complete. Our work is recognition. And as we awaken moment by moment, we discover that all along we have been living in the unfolding expression of God's, Spirit's, the universe's eternal mind." We turn now to the March-April issue 2026 of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and Sylvia Hayes' monthly column, Sacred Earth Connections. And she's a speaker, author, and Unity minister. Her Substack Transcend is about raised consciousness, economic system change, and a world that works better for all. She's also the former First Lady of Oregon. Visit Sylvia, C-Y-L-V-I-A, Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S, .com. The Magic Beyond the Veil. 10 years ago, I was in a life crisis, falsely accused of using a political position for personal gain. I became media clickbait, the subject of an intense and prolonged public shaming, and literally overnight, I lost my position, my business, and most of my colleagues and alleged friends. Every day, new inaccurate stories, cruel comments, and hate mail flowed in. The fear became so intense, I could smell it in my sweat and feel it seeping from my pores. I couldn't see a way forward. One morning, I dragged myself into the tiny hot tub on my deck. It was bitterly cold. Shell-shocked and exhausted, my mind finally couldn't race anymore, and something shifted. I became deeply, intensely present in that moment. I'd been in that tub on many cold mornings when steam billowed off the hot water, but I'd never truly seen the steam and the light beams before that day. I became aware of rich layers of sound and the silence behind them. I lost track of the boundaries of my physical body and felt an incredible expansion and connection to all creation. This wasn't my first mystical experience, but it was the most intense, profoundly exposing the myth of separation, the false belief that we are isolated islands of consciousness, divided from one another and from the natural world. This myth shapes our treatment of other beings in deep, heartbreaking ways. Humanity grapples with many isms: tribalism, racism, sexism, but we've barely begun to recognize speciesism, the belief that non-human species are of lesser intelligence, emotional capacity, and value. Speciesism allows us to treat other species in ways that would be criminal if done to a human. Amen. It allows us to justify an economy that accepts the eradication of entire species in pursuit of growth, an economy that drives the cascading ecological crises now confronting us. Ecosystem collapse always harms human communities, demonstrating our interconnectedness. We rely on pollinators to grow crops, forests for protection from wind and drought, and grasses to hold soil in place. We depend on other species for our food and on bacteria in our bodies for normal digestion and immune function. But beyond the material, our lives are also made richer on a spiritual level by the diversity of life on our planet. New Thought spirituality teaches that separation is the ultimate illusion, and that in reality, there is one consciousness expressing through infinite forms: the sparrow, the whale, the dog sleeping at our feet, the tree climbing into the sky. These are each unique manifestations of the same universal intelligence that animates our own being. A tree's intelligence isn't less than ours, it's just different, adapted perfectly to its purpose in the web of life. The consciousness expressing itself as a dolphin kept alone in captivity, or as a cow in a slaughterhouse, carries the same spark of divine awareness we treasure in ourselves. When we truly internalize the principle of oneness, our relationship with other species transforms, expanding our circle of compassion. As we embody the reality of interconnection, our choices about what we wear and eat and where we build roads and buildings become spiritual practices in themselves. The dissolution of speciesism isn't about guilt, but rather expanding our awareness to match the truth of what we are. We are not separate selves competing for resources in a hostile universe. We are one with the universe itself, tentacles on the octopus of God, each unique but inextricably connected to the whole. When we truly know this, compassion becomes as natural as breathing, and our experience of the world dances with magic. And from the same issue, we turn to Roadside Assistance for the Spiritual Traveler by Rabbi Rami Shapiro. The Failings of Organized Religion. Question: talk of war, deportations, and pedophilia infiltrates every part of my life. Why isn't religion a shield against these issues? Rabbi Rami: religion isn't a shield against war, deportations, or pedophilia because it originates from the same mindset that causes them. The violence we see outside reflects the violence we hold inside. Only an internal awakening, God realization, self-realization, enlightenment, Buddha mind, the mind of Christ, and so on, can break the dualistic mindset that fuels this madness. However, such awakening also challenges organized religion, which is why no organized religion does more than pay lip service to it and why religious leaders often replace the revolutionary teachings of their founders, Buddha, Micah, Christ, Muhammad, and so on, with dogmas, theology, and bureaucratic hierarchies that actually oppose those teachings. Question. I'm on a road trip through sparsely populated parts of the West with plenty of time to think about God. I've heard it said that God is either everything or God is nothing. Is that it? Rabbi Rami. God is both everything and nothing. Yesh, being, and Ayin, non-being, Judaism. Presence and absence, Taoism. And Saguna Brahman, the absolute with form, and Nirguna Brahman, the absolute without form, Hinduism. As you drive along, notice the peaks and valleys that make up the physical world. If you use a smartphone, think of the ones and zeros that comprise the digital world. All these elements come together in what the Chinese call Taiji, the supreme ultimate that encompasses and transcends all opposites. Instead of thinking about God during your journey, observe God manifesting as both form and emptiness, and realize the truth of the Buddhist Heart Sutra's teaching. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Question. Our book club was formed around your book, Perennial Wisdom for the Spiritually Independent. The group is mostly women, and I wonder if this is because women are more spiritual than men. Rabbi Rami. I suspect that something more complex is unfolding. Perennial wisdom or perennial philosophy offers a direct and egalitarian path to spiritual awakening and ethical living, free from parochial boundaries and patriarchal biases. It often reemerges when masculine, us against them, worldviews clash with feminine, inclusive perspectives. In the modern West, this began in the late 19th and early 20th centuries with the rise of transcendentalism, Vedanta Theosophy, New Thought, including Unity, and other groups that are open to women leaders and the Divine Mother. I recommend reading Andrew Harvey's The Return of the Mother, Philip Goldberg's American Veda, and Rosemary Anderson's The Divine Feminine, Tao Te Ching, to learn more. Question. I teach Sunday school to teens. Each year the big question is, why does God allow evil? My answer is, evil is a human choice. People have free will to make that choice because we're created in God's image, and God has free will. They never ask if God is free to do evil. I'm afraid to ask it of them, so I'll ask it of you. Is God free to do evil? Rabbi Rami. No, God is not free to do evil. God is not free at all. God is what is, the infinite non-dual reality, in whom we live and move and have our being, manifesting everything and its opposite in its proper time and season. Humans are part of that manifesting, and we do what we do because the conditions ripening at any particular moment are such that we can do nothing else. Things happen because they must happen. The ones we like, we call good. The ones we dislike, we call evil. Instead of asking, why does evil happen, ask, how can we minimize the circumstances that cause evil to happen? And how can we alleviate suffering when evil does happen? Question. Like you, I'm in my 70s. Like you, I want to change the world. What else can I do besides pray? Rabbi Rami. The world is always changing. I wake up each morning and recite a Hebrew affirmation, Elohai neshama shenatata bi Torah, which I interpret as, my true self is pure divine consciousness. Then I consult the I Ching, the ancient Chinese book of changes, asking, how can I best engage the world for my true self? In this way, I seek guidance on how to navigate the winds of change and align with Rabbi Hillel's golden rule, what is hateful to you, do not do to another. Afterward, I keep turning the cryptic message from the I Ching over in my mind as a catalyst for intuitive insight. By all means, pray, but don't just pray, inquire. And we'll continue with further questions from Rabbi Rami in future weeks. We pause for a moment to remind you that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. We continue now with The Light Between Us, Stories from Heaven, Lessons for the Living by Laura Lynn Jackson. And we had started Chapter 18, The Policeman's Cap. With my energy and my abilities rebalanced, I was ready to do readings again. Around that time, I got a call from Fran Ginsberg at the Forever Family Foundation, inviting me to participate in a special event called How to Listen When Your Children Speak. 10 sets of parents who had lost a child would be there, along with one psychic medium, me. I swallowed hard and told Fran I'd do it. All right, so she started with some readings, and she started with one family, Joe and Marianne, and their daughter became ill and died quite suddenly. Jesse passed away a few days after Easter. Joe and Marianne left Jesse's bedroom just the way it was, as if they expected her to come bouncing in any minute. To stay busy, they focused on the memorial service and funeral. Instead of birthday gifts, they picked out a headstone. "Nothing made sense," says Joe. "It made zero sense. Jesse was here and then she wasn't here. Why did this happen? Why, Jesse? Why are we even here, any of us, if something like this can just happen?" "We questioned our faith in life," says Marianne. "We were searching and grasping for answers, but there were none. Life didn't have any purpose, not with Jesse gone. Why do we get to be here and not her?" I didn't know the extent of their despair as I stood before them in the conference room, but I knew Jessie hadn't just disappeared. She was right there with us, full of love and life, and she had a million things to say. "She wants to thank you for the butterflies," I told Joe and Marianne. They looked at each other, and Marianne reached for a tissue. I didn't know why butterflies were meaningful, and I didn't have to. Clearly, her parents did. I later learned that Joe and Marianne had recently chosen their daughter's gravestone, and they picked a stone carved with butterflies floating above Jesse's name. Jesse had loved butterflies. But that was just the beginning. "She's showing me an animal," I went on, "a cat. A cat in a tree. A cat stuck on a branch in a tree?" I looked at Joe and Marianne for affirmation, but there was none. That was okay. I knew that sometimes messages from the other side don't make sense until later. I asked them to remember her message, since it might be validated at a later time. A few weeks after the reading, Joe was raking leaves in the backyard when he saw Jesse's favorite stuffed cat wedged in a tree branch. Instantly, he remembered why it was there. She'd forgotten it in the yard one day, and he'd picked it up and absently put it in the tree so the family's golden retriever wouldn't chew it up. The detail hadn't clicked with him in the conference room, but Jesse had shared it so Joe could carry this detail around with him and make sense of it just when he most needed to feel his daughter's presence. Jesse kept on going. "I'm seeing a hat, sort of like a policeman's cap," I said. "Jesse is showing me a blue policeman's cap. I'm supposed to talk to you about the hat. Are you a policeman?" Joe looked startled. More than that, stunned. Later he explained the significance of the policeman's cap. Before she died, Jesse had gone to a camp for teens run by the state police department. It was just the kind of thing that Jesse, an adventurous soul, loved doing. Joe gave her $50 and asked her to buy him a policeman's cap. But Jesse spent the money on something else and forgot to buy the cap. No one thought anything of it. Then, at Jesse's funeral, something inexplicable happened. A police officer came up to Joe. The two men had never met. In the officer's hand was a blue policeman's cap. The policeman struggled to find the right words. "I got this hat for you," he told Joe, his eyes filling with tears. I don't know why. I really don't. I just know I'm supposed to give it to you." Joe took the hat in his hand, turned it around and around, and stared at it. Then he hugged the cop. The other side, it seems, can make just about anyone a messenger, as long as the person chosen is willing to keep his or her heart and mind open to the other side. The policeman could have ignored his strange compulsion to give Joe a cap. Luckily, he didn't. Jesse showed me the hat because it was something only Joe and Marianne would know about. Not even the police officer knew why the cap was significant. But Jesse wanted me to share it so her parents would know that she was there with them in the conference room. Next, she showed me her illness. She showed me her whole body, which I understood meant that she had had an illness that affected her everywhere, Then she brought me up to her head. She was showing me her illness had spread and affected her brain. She also showed me a 3-day timeline. It was a fast-moving illness. It poisoned her whole system, I told her parents. It went through her blood and up into her brain. When it moved into her brain is when you had to let her go. Joe and Marianne had never told anyone, about the bleeding in Jesse's brain. They never told anyone that it was the reason they'd taken her off life support. But Jesse showed it to me to offer further proof that she was there. Maybe she knew her parents needed a lot of convincing. Maybe she knew that all of the details that would be the one truly convinced them that she was present. And it was. This is what Jesse wants to tell you, I said. She wants you to understand she has not left you. She's never going to leave you. She is always going to be your daughter, and she will always love you. You haven't lost her, and you will never lose her. Please understand you can never lose her. In the hospital on the day Jesse died, Marianne had held her hand, stroked her hair, and said, "You are our best friend in the world." And now, 3 months later, in a conference room on Long Island, Jesse took those beautiful words and brought them right back to her parents. "Jesse isn't gone," I said. "Jesse will never be gone. She is with you always, and she will always be your best friend." Chapter 19, The Final Child. That night in the conference room, the children kept coming, boys and girls, some as young as 5, some in their teens, some even older. They gave me clear, identifying details to prove to their parents that they were there before having me stress over and over how much they needed their parents to know they weren't truly gone. I was pulled toward a man and woman whose daughter had been killed while riding her bike. She wanted to tell them to let go of their guilt, that there was nothing they could have done to prevent what happened. "And she wants to thank you for putting her artwork up in the living room," I said, "so that she could still be present in your lives." One young man came through and showed me he had drowned along with 2 of his friends. "He wants you to know that he crossed with his friends, that he was never alone," I told his parents. "And when he got to the other side, his grandfather and the family dog were waiting there to greet him." All the children who came through wanted the same thing, to somehow ease their loved ones' pain and anguish. They made it so their parents could see a glimmer of light from the other side, and just that tiny glimmer allowed them to see a pathway out of their darkness. The readings went on and on. I didn't realize it, but more than 3 hours had passed since I'd started. So much had happened in those 3 hours, and a powerful sense of relief, of hope, filled the once morbid room. The people who were going home that night were not the same people who had arrived. Their torment had been lessened, not ended, but lessened. Their children had given them the most beautiful, magical, powerful gift, the understanding that they weren't gone. I was exhausted and exhilarated and overwhelmed by all the love passed back and forth that night. But still, something wasn't right. Something felt wrong. All of the children had come through, except for one. I scanned the room and found a person I hadn't yet spoken to, a woman in her early 40s with black hair. She was a single mother, I would later learn, and the only parent there without a spouse. She sat patiently at the very head of the conference table, but no one had come through for her. What was going on? Most of the parents had left the room when the black-haired woman slowly rose to her feet, turned, and shuffled toward the exit. I could feel her staggering disappointment, but what was I supposed to do? And then it hit me. Her child wanted to be last. I hurried toward the woman and put my hand on her shoulder. "Wait," I said. "Please stay. I will stay late with you." We sat at the conference table, just the 2 of us, and just as we settled in, someone came through for her. This point of light was not on the upper right of my screen, the strong and clear part. It was somewhere lower. It felt like I was listening to a really low and deep vibration, something I had to concentrate on to make sense of. Plus, this person's light was much less intense than the others had been, and I had to pull my own energy down low, much lower than where it had been all evening, in order to pull hers out. That's why we had to wait for the room to empty out, I realized. This reading was different. Finally, I could see it was a girl, a young woman, really, 20 years old. The information was faint, but I could make it out. "You're a psychiatrist," I said to her mother. The woman's face froze. Then I saw a college building and letters, 3 letters. "Your daughter's telling me she went to NYU, I said. The daughter showed me where her mother lived and a few other details, and she showed me animals, small animals, cats. Your daughter wants to thank you for taking care of her cats, I said. She is really grateful to you for being so loving with them. The cats were the detail that did it. I could feel her mom's energy open more fully to the reading and to her daughter's messages. Then the young woman showed me how she died, though I already knew. She had killed herself. Suicides often come through as lower lights. This woman's daughter had waited so long to come through because she didn't want the fact of her suicide to come up in front of other parents. She'd waited until her mother had more privacy. She showed me how she'd tried to kill herself once before when she was 16, and how hard her mother had tried to help her then. Then she showed me how she'd finally done it. She'd overdosed on pills, and she showed me that she'd been going to do it no matter what her mother or anyone else did. This was her choice. This was her doorway. She had stopped her soul's journey on earth, and only after she crossed did she realize what a gift life is. I told all this to the mother, who was crying. Though it had started out weak, the connection had become strong and profound. I could feel the incredible love passing between this mother and her daughter. And for the first time that evening, tears ran down my face. It was one of the most powerful moments I'd ever experienced. Your daughter wants you to know that if she had understood how bad this would be for you, how painful it would be, she never would have done it, I went on. She is so sorry that she did it. We were at the very heart of it now. This was what the mother most needed to hear. Your daughter wants to thank you, I said. She wants to thank you for trying and for understanding. But most of all, she wants to thank you for what you did for her after she passed. In the all but empty room, I delivered the message. Your daughter wants to thank you for forgiving her. I stayed with the girl's mother for 40 minutes. When we were done, Bob and Fran hugged me and thanked me. They were very happy with how the evening had turned out. As for me, whatever exhaustion I'd felt went away after that last reading. Instead, I felt completely energized. I'd been able to help all the parents connect with their children and deliver these wonderful messages of love. The realization that I could do that, that I could play a part in this miraculous process of healing, was very meaningful for me. I knew in that moment once and for all that the abilities I had feared were a curse were actually a blessing. I got back in my car and raced home. I was on such a high, I was still buzzing. I know that might sound strange, considering I just spent 4 hours with grieving parents talking about unthinkably sad events. But the truth was, we'd all shared a miraculous moment. The children were there with their parents in that room. Love goes on and on. The night hadn't been about death and darkness at all. It had been about light and life and love. It was 11 p.m. I called Garrett and told him that the evening had gone great. I told you it would, he said. I'll be home soon, I said. And just as I said that, I realized I wasn't alone in the car. The children were still with me. It was not that they had more messages to share. It was just that they, too, were still buzzing. All of my readings have a triangle effect with three energies at play. Mine, the sitter's, and the energy of those on the other side. We were all feeling the same thing that night. Like me, the children were giddy. Eventually, they left, but I could still feel a presence in the car. It was a child, but it wasn't one of the children who came through in the conference room. This child had a message to share, too. I pulled into the driveway and quietly made my way inside the house. I gave Garrett a big hug and kiss and tiptoed in to see my sleeping babies. I cracked open the door to Ashley's bedroom and stood over her. She was my angel, my precious angel. I bent down, gave her a kiss on the cheek, and pulled her blanket up around her shoulders. Then I crept into Hayden's room, kissed him, and tucked him in. I ran my fingers gently over his soft hair. I tried to never take a moment with my children for granted. I knew better than that. I knew how lucky I was. In the kitchen, I got out some chips and dip and ate like I hadn't eaten in a week. Then I told Garrett I still had a little business to attend to. I went to our bedroom and closed the door. The night of the FFF group reading, I was aware that Fran and Bob had a daughter who had passed, but I didn't know anything about her or how she'd crossed. What I did know, as I drove home from the Huntington Hilton, was that the child in the car with me was their daughter, Bailey. I would have phoned Bob and Fran, but I was afraid it was too late to call. Instead, I wrote them an email. All night, Bob and Fran had stayed behind the scenes. They'd sat off to the side, silently cheering on the grieving parents, pulling for the children to come through. They had put aside their own pain, their own loss, and focused on helping other parents. But now there was a message for them. All the children who came through want to thank you for making the event happen, I wrote. The other side tells me you are healing more people than you know. Bailey is so proud of you, I continued. I saw her standing behind all the other children on my screen, beaming with pride and joy. She is so beautiful. Bailey also wanted to mark a significant date coming up. Is it someone's birthday or anniversary right around now in your family, I asked. Bailey is acknowledging an important date and letting you know she will always be a part of your lives. The next day, Fran wrote back. She thanked me warmly for the reading and told me the anniversary of Bailey's passing was 3 days away. You surely had Bailey there with you that night, Fran wrote. Some children are not meant to be here long. Some are here for only a short while, but in that time they learn and teach profound lessons about love. And their impact on the world doesn't end when they cross. They're always around to teach us about love. Bailey was only here for 15 years, but she continues to change our world for the better. Because of Bob and Fran's transcendent love for her, they created the Forever Family Foundation, and now the three of them, Bob, Fran, and Bailey, work together as a team of light and healing. Chapter 20. The Trapped Bee. About a year after the FFF event, I read for a New York City couple, Charlie and Roseanne. I saw that they had been married a long time and that they didn't have children. But as I further opened the door to the other side, a point of light appeared on my screen. I could sense that the point of light was not a person at all. It was a dog. I'm seeing a large black dog with an S name, I told them. Charlie and Roseanne told me that the first dog they had together was a lovely Doberman lab mix named Shadow. More points of light came through. I was dazzled by them. They were an entirely new experience for me. It wasn't just Shadow, the dog, coming through. It was all kinds of different animals. Points of light lined up one behind the other. The lights kept coming and coming. A whole menagerie of animals, and all with the same message. It was a message of gratitude, recognition, and love. I felt a wave of pure love sweeping back and forth between the sitters and the other side. It was so intense, I couldn't make out all the animals that were there. All I knew was that there were a lot of them. I wondered what Charlie and Roseanne had done to create such a powerful exchange of love and gratitude. Charlie grew up in the Bronx. Roseanne was from Brooklyn. They were both raised in families that loved and often saved animals. I had a knack for rescuing parakeets, Charlie told me. They'd escape their cages in someone's apartment and end up on our fire escape. I'd throw a towel over them and get them inside. It wasn't easy, but I wound up with 5 parakeets. For Roseanne, it wasn't all about feral cats and stray dogs. There was a family of cats that lived in the storage area of our building, and my mother and I brought them in, she said. A mother and 2 kittens, Blackie and Gray. We fed them and loved them and nurtured them. The dogs we already had were pretty good about having cats around. When Charlie and Roseanne started dating in their 20s, they bonded over their love of animals. Once they were together, many more strays wound up in their path. They didn't go around looking for animals to save. The animals in need always seemed to find them. That is how it happens. There was Stripes, the cat who showed up on their stoop looking banged up. She'd been hit by a car and had a broken hip. There were Stars and Fang and Mommy and Heidi and Baby and Snow. Feral cats they'd found in alleyways or on the street. There was a huge tabby named Reginald Van Cat and a mutt named Farfel. We would turn a corner in Brooklyn and see 2 dogs chained to a fence, says Roseanne. What were we supposed to do, walk away? But it wasn't just cats and dogs. They went shopping at a mall one day and found 2 baby sparrows huddled in the remnants of a nest in a shopping cart. They'd just been hatched and their eyes were closed, but they were cold to the touch. Charlie and Roseanne took them inside and warmed them, and against all odds, the sparrows, whom they named Heckle and Jekyll, survived. Charlie and Roseanne found them a home in a wild bird sanctuary. Another time, they were in their apartment building's garage when they heard the faint sound of chirping. They searched for an hour to find the source of the chirping, and finally found a newborn sparrow tucked behind a snow tire. It couldn't fly, so they took it outside and put it under a bush so the bird's parents could find her. When they checked back an hour later, the sparrow was still there. So Charlie and Roseanne took her in, nursed her back to health, and then set her free. Then there were the duck and ducklings trapped on the New Jersey Turnpike with cars and trucks zipping by at 70 miles per hour. I spotted them waddling into the left lane, Roseanne said. One driver braked really hard and the ducks kept going into the center lane. Then another driver braked and then the ducks were in front of me. And so I braked and they kept walking across the highway onto the shoulder. I looked in my rearview mirror and saw a giant tractor trailer bearing down at me at full speed. Roseanne said a quick prayer. Without slowing down and at the last second, the tractor trailer veered onto the shoulder around Roseanne's car, narrowly missing both her and the ducks. It swung back onto the highway and kept going, and the ducks just kept walking. It was as if all of us had this group consciousness and we were able to miss the ducks, says Roseanne. We stayed there until they were safely off the turnpike. There were others. The wounded stray dog in Cozumel, Mexico. They convinced a local doctor to treat it with human medicine. The young pigeon that tumbled out of its nest 25 feet up in an overpass. They convinced local firemen to take it back up on a ladder. The tiny toad struggling not to get swept away by waves crashing into a parking lot during a storm. Charlie braved the waves, scooped up the toad, and found it a safe place on the other side of the boardwalk. One April afternoon, Charlie and Roseanne took a walk along the waterfront in downtown Manhattan. They noticed a group of people gathered at the guardrail pointing at something in the water. A 30-foot-long humpback whale had been spotted on the waters beneath the Thorazano Narrows Bridge and was heading away from the open sea. This wasn't good news for the whale. The whale ran the risk of getting hit by a boat or caught in netting. Unless it headed out to sea, it wouldn't survive. Charlie and Roseanne joined the group and watched as the Coast Guard set up a perimeter around the whale. They tried to shield it from ships, but there was no way to steer it away from the harbor. It was up to the whale to do that. The people watching decided to try to will the whale back out to sea. They all focused very hard and sent the whale a message. For a long while, the whale wouldn't budge. Then suddenly it began to head in the right direction, away from the perimeter and toward the open water south of Coney Island. With one great final leap forward, the whale pushed away from the harbor and disappeared beneath the surface on its way to safety. And the people on shore? They didn't cheer. Everyone was quiet. They sensed that they had all been part of something magical. We stood quietly on the shore, says Charlie, and imagined the whale swimming back home. Then there was the tiny little bee. Charlie and Roseanne were strolling along the boardwalk at Jones Beach when they noticed a bee on the ground. One of its minuscule legs was caught between two planks of wood on the boardwalk. You could see the bee was trying to yank its leg out and free itself, Roseanne said. I don't know how someone hadn't stepped on it already. Roseanne got down on her hands and knees and gently pulled on one of the planks until the bee was free. But he didn't fly away because he was too exhausted, she recalled. I slid him onto a tissue, and we took him to a garden and put him near the flowers. Soon enough, he started buzzing around the flowers. During my reading with Charlie and Roseanne, I saw an image of a cruise ship and a pigeon. I had no idea what it meant, but I mentioned it in our reading. Later, I would learn the story of the pigeon on the ship. The couple was on a European cruise when they noticed a pigeon walking on the deck. They wondered what it was doing in the middle of the North Sea and stayed with it until it flew away. 2 hours later, they retired below deck to their cabin. When they opened the door, they saw the pigeon on their bed. Their room had a balcony. They must have left the balcony door open. There had to be 1,000 cabins on that boat, but somehow the pigeon had found theirs. They got some dinner rolls, scraped off the seeds, and made a little dish of food for the pigeon on the balcony. The pigeon ate the seeds and found a comfortable spot to rest. She stayed on their balcony until the ship docked in its next port, Amsterdam. Then she flew away. Before she did, Charlie had noticed a small tag around one of her legs. It had a series of numbers on the tag they recognized as a phone number. The number was from the Netherlands, and when they got to Amsterdam, Charlie dialed it. We reached someone who connected us to the owner of the pigeon. Charlie told me it was a racing pigeon, and it was supposed to fly across the North Sea and end up in France. I guess it needed a little breather, so it wound up on our ship. The owner was so happy to hear from us and to know the pigeon was safe. My reading with Charlie and Roseanne was one of the densest readings I've ever done. So much love and so many messages poured through the open pathway. I could hardly keep up. A few animals came through more clearly than others. Shadow, their first dog together, was one of them. But I also got specific information about an animal that hadn't crossed yet, one of their beloved cats. You have a cat right now who's having a lot of trouble walking, I said. He had a stroke and he's very sick, but he's not ready to leave you just yet. He wants to stay. So you should wait, because in 2 weeks he'll be able to walk. And I see a timeline stretching 7 months, which means he will stay with you another 7 months. Charlie and Roseanne were taken aback. Their beloved cat Reggie had indeed just had a stroke. He was barely able to walk at all, and they were all but certain his days were numbered. He couldn't even stand up, Roseanne told me later. We had to lift him up just to get him into a box of cat litter. Honestly, we were thinking it was time to put him down. But since the other side said to wait 2 weeks, they waited. 2 weeks later, Reggie strolled into their bedroom like nothing was wrong. Then he ran and cuddled with them, and he stayed with them another 7 months. I had another reading with Charlie and Roseanne after Reggie crossed, and this time he came through too. Reggie is telling me he can't believe that now he gets to be up on the bed with you, I told him. He can't believe his luck, and he is so happy about it. Roseanne laughed and confirmed they'd never let Reggie sleep with them, because if they let one cat on the bed, they'd have to let them all on. I've had a few more readings with Charlie and Roseanne since then, and every time I've been flooded by love and thanks from the other side. All the animals they rescued and saved over the last 30 years, the cats and dogs and sparrows and toads and pigeons and ducklings and even the tiny bee, have come through with waves of love and gratitude. Charlie and Roseanne have devoted their lives to helping and loving the weak and wounded creatures among us, and for that, the other side is bursting with appreciation. My readings for Charlie and Roseanne have taught me a great deal. They reinforce my understanding of the importance of our free will. The choices we make, particularly every act of kindness, are greatly consequential. It matters because they honor the greatest gift we possess, the infinite capacity to love and heal even the smallest of creatures. And we'll continue with a little more about them in next week's episode. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher Program.